following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a new biography of Queen Isabella of Spain. Today, we remember her mostly for sending Columbus across the ocean blue in 1492, but that does much disservice to a woman who ranks among the most powerful and influential world leaders in history, male or female. My guest today reminds us that Isabella achieved many great things, but many terrible things as well. During her 30-year reign from 1474 to 1504, she claimed the Castilian throne for herself, much to her husband Ferdinand's surprise. With Ferdinand, who was the heir to Aragon, they unified Spain, and after 10 years of hard war, expelled the Muslim Empire from the south of Spain in Granada. She then embarked on exploration and claimed the Western Hemisphere for herself. But in unifying Spain, she unleashed a huge wave of anti-Semitism and religious intolerance, culminating in the Inquisition and the murder, torture, or forced conversion of thousands of Jewish and Muslim believers. Not to mention the atrocities and disease spread in the New World in the name of the Spanish crown. But there's no denying that Isabella moved Spain from a backwater to world power during the course of her reign. My guest today is the author of the first new biography on Isabella in over 20 years. Kirsten Downey is the author of Isabella, the Warrior Queen, published by Doubleday. Kirsten Downey is author of the previous book, The Woman Behind the New Deal, a biography of Frances Perkins, which was a finalist for the 2009 Los Angeles Times Book Prize. She was one of the writers of the New York Times bestselling report on the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and was previously a staff writer at the Washington Post, where she shared in the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the Virginia Tech shootings. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Kirsten Downey, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be with you, Rich.
Now, how did you get interested in the story of Isabella? Every school child knows that Queen Isabella sent Columbus across the ocean blue in 1492, but she is really, along with Queen Elizabeth, she's probably one of the major women figures in the world, say, for about a millennia.
That's exactly true. She had a massive impact on the world, and a huge impact on North and South America. I guess, well, my father was a ship captain, and so I traveled around a lot as a child. My mother and my siblings and I would travel wherever my dad's ships were going to come in so we could spend as much time as we could with him. And so in the course of my childhood, we went a lot of places. So when I was about 6 years old, we went for the first time to the Jacksonville area, and I saw Port St. Augustine for the first time. They call that Castillo de San Marcos. It's a Spanish fortress on a spectacular location in St. Augustine, Florida. And I was only six, but I was really impressed the way a little child is seeing a fort for the first time. You know, the thick walls. They showed us where the Spanish soldiers had slept, and there was so little concern for their comfort. I really got a sense of the adversity they suffered, and I was fascinated by this huge fort that had been built so far from Spain. Then later, I kept having that same feeling of shock and amazement, thinking of the expanse of the Spanish Empire. And, of course, the Spaniards very early arrived in Oklahoma as well. My father got a job as a ship pilot in the Panama Canal. And so when we went down there, it was very hard. I was in the 60s. It was very hard to even get to Panama at that time from the United States. First, we had to drive down to New Orleans, and then we got a ship down to Panama. And, you know, Panama was such a different environment than the United States, the thick jungle and everything. And I was fascinated by that. And there was a day early on that we went to visit a place called Fort San Lorenzo in Panama. And it was a fortress overlooking the entrance to the Chagres River in Panama. And I realized to my amazement at that point at age 9 that it was an exact duplicate of what I'd just seen in St. Augustine. Thousands of miles away, those same little Spanish soldiers had come and built an identical fortress thousands of miles from Spain. And then we traveled a good bit around the country and around the Americas in the course of my dad's work and his tourists. And everywhere I went, I was reminded of the importance of Spain. And everywhere, when we went to California, Well, we visited San Francisco. We visited San Jose. We went to Los Angeles. We went to San Diego. You really get a feeling. Once we took a trip to Peru and Chile, and we went to Lima, and then we went to Santiago de Chile. And you really get a sense of these people really got around. And that took me to this question. Well, we know Columbus was audacious in his explorations, but something really remarkable happened that Spain had decided to plant its flag all over the Americas so very early. And that took me back to the person who was responsible for that. And my mind kept going back again and again to Isabella, who was the sponsor of the expeditions.
It's quite an unlikely story. Isabella was born with little fanfare in 1451.
Yeah.
In fact, little is known about her earliest life because she was not expected to be a queen.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about Isabella's early life. I think you write about her influence from Joan of Arc. And
yes.
This was a big influence on her because she was very pious in her beliefs, and also sort of this sense of destiny seemed to be about her.
Yes. Joan of Arc was burned at the stake in the late 1400s as a heretic after successfully leading the French troops into battle against the English. And so there was a lot of stigma about Joan for 20 years after that. And there was an effort to open up the investigation of Joan of Arc's life again. They reinvestigated the case. The inquiry was opened by the Vatican. They reinvestigated the case, and when Isabella was about 5 or 6 years old, they basically announced that it had been a mistake to kill her, that she had been, in fact, saintly, and that what she had done was a triumphant defense of her religious principles. And this ended up having huge resonance throughout Isabella's life. She appropriated a lot of the imagery, the sword up in the air, upright in the air, and a lot of the religious imagery in taking on what she saw as the defense of her own Catholicism and religious faith in Spain.
But at the time of her birth in Spain, Spain was not Spain. It was Castile. It was Aragon.
Right.
It was Granada. It was a mixture of Portugal was still there, but Portugal perhaps was even certainly more organized than the areas of Spain at that particular time.
Yeah, Spain was in disarray. It was in complete civil war, and it had these different kingdoms that were essentially at war with each other constantly. Isabella's marriage to Ferdinand, who was the heir of the Kingdom of Aragon, which is the part of the coast that goes like Barcelona down to like Valencia, was a significant marriage. They unified those kingdoms. She represented Castile and León, and he did Aragon. That brought them together. But Spain at that time, Iberia, much of the peninsula, was at war. All pieces of it were at war with each other. And it's funny because it's often been described as that Spain was a peaceful place, a land of religious tolerance. In some ways, that is true. But if anyone who has visited Spain will tell you, the reason it's called Castile, or the biggest kingdom is called Castile, is because everyone lived behind fortress walls. The world was seen as such a dangerous place where people could attack you at any time. So she grew up in a place and time where people were fearful for their very lives, and she had a terrifying childhood herself.
Now, given what happens during Isabella's reign, which is the time of the Inquisition, after she unifies Spain, you investigated those sort of stories of Spain was a place where Jews, Christians, and Muslims could live together peacefully.
Yes.
And certainly in Granada, which was the Moorish part of Spain, there was a time when that happened, but very quickly Christians and Jews became second-class citizens there. And the same was true in other parts of Spain. There was tremendous discrimination most of the time.
That's right. There was tremendous discrimination, and there was a factor that is hard for us to imagine now but was very true, and that's that slavery was common in all parts of Europe at that time, but it was practiced most energetically by the Muslims, who believed that it was acceptable to enslave non-believers, Christians and Jews, and they did so in great numbers. They would raid into the north of Spain. They would raid across the southern Mediterranean, and they would seize people to be made slaves, sex slaves, and for men and women, both sex, boys and girls, both all sex slaves, and also to draft into military service.
Yeah. Well, as Isabella's growing up, it's remarkable she made it to womanhood, really, frankly, because of the intrigues within the Spanish court. Her older stepbrother was the king, a very vacillating person, and you speculate that he probably was gay and that the activities in the court were far different than we see in movies today.
Well, there's some of the foreign visitors were shocked by what they saw, and it was a licentious court, and Isabel was a basically orphaned girl growing up in a very licentious court who was worried about surviving and also trying very hard to preserve her own dignity.
And it was also a place that sounded very Romanesque, where any pretenders to the throne had better watch their food carefully, because there were a lot of people who died in mysterious circumstances.
Yeah, Isabella had a younger brother who would have been the next heir to the throne after her older brother, and he probably was poisoned. Mm-hmm. And she was at his side when he died, and that was a horrific event to see.
Now, King Enrique, who was her older stepbrother, perhaps even survived a poisoning at one point?
Well, there's a lot of ambiguity about all this, and nobody knows for sure. And I suppose someday bodies will be exhumed and examined, and we'll know more about who actually died of what poisonings. But her own older brother, Enrique the King, who in some ways she really loved, too, did die mysteriously. And he did die mysteriously after coming in contact with Isabella's unusual husband, King Ferdinand.
Yeah. That whole story of how Ferdinand and Isabella came together is somewhat interesting, too, because Ferdinand was the heir apparent to Aragon. Isabella was not supposed to be the heir. In fact, after her other brother's death that you mentioned earlier, she sort of forced herself to be named as heir because the king had a female heir, but it was so widely suspected that his wife had had that birth with someone else, and in fact that he was not really interested in her. In fact, the speculation was that he was gay, that there was sort of widespread resentment against accepting that child as the heir to the throne. So Isabel made herself the heir.
And it's
soap crazy.
Opera, isn't it?
It really is.
I know. It's a real-life soap opera. Yes, it is.
But nonetheless, after having everything from proposals made to Richard III, to Edward IV in England, I think it was at one point somebody else in Aragon to somebody in Portugal, she actually sort of makes her own mind up and decides to marry Ferdinand, which was pretty unheard of in royal families at the time.
Quite extraordinary, and she really did it at risk of her life because she was specifically defying her brother, the king. And nevertheless, when she looked around the landscape of the available men that were that would be a good match for a prospective queen, she picked the one who was the cutest and who was closest to her age and had a lot of charm, charisma, and energy. He also had a very high libido, which ended up having a lot of effect on her life. They had a lot of children together, but he also had a lot of children with other women.
Now, it also sort of shows the spine that would show up once she became ruler, which was that, you know, she went her own way. She defied the crown. She defied the crown on several occasions. She would sort of come back into the orbit from time to time, but most of the time she was at odds. And then once Enrique died, she basically said, I'm the queen. Even though she was married to Ferdinand, and I think Aragon thought, oh, this is the way we'll take over Castile, she became the queen.
Her brother, Ferdinand, was in Aragon at the time that her brother Enrique died. And he was assuming that he would be the real king. And when her brother died, She sent a very slow messenger to her husband to tell him the event had occurred and took the crown for herself. And Ferdinand showed up 2 weeks later when she had already claimed the throne.
Wow. And what was the reaction from Ferdinand?
He was furious. He was furious. He was shocked. He didn't think it was legal for a woman to take the throne.
But it wasn't Castile.
He was challenged. It also hurt his ego. It was embarrassing. Now he was going to be married to someone who would outrank him. It was awkward.
Now, it was allowable to have a female monarch in Castile. It was not in Aragon.
That's right. And it was even very unusual even in Castile, although it had been 200 years since a woman had been queen. And some of the earlier queens had been viewed as having had very unsuccessful reigns. So not there was a precedent for it, but it was a pretty shaky precedent.
My guest today is Kirsten Downey, the biographer and former staff writer at the Washington Post. Her latest book is titled Isabella, the Warrior Queen. It's published by Doubleday, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. It's a fascinating look at this amazing monarch, because once she becomes queen, she immediately consolidates her power.
Yes.
Immediately, her surrounding enemies at that time, Portugal and Granada, the Moorish Empire, basically see, a woman has taken the throne. This is ripe for the taking. They declare war. She fends off first the Portuguese and basically sends them back to Portugal. And then she takes on the Moorish Empire and drives the Moors out of Spain within, seven, 8 years?
Well, she took the throne in 1473. It took her about almost 20 years to do all that. The reconquest, the war against the Moors took 10 long and horrible years. It was very bloody. The losses on both sides were great. The Moors, we call them the Moors, they were Muslims, were very brave soldiers and gallant in their own way and fighting to preserve what for them had been their home for 700 years by that point. And it was a brutal battle, and it was done by siege. It was done by long marches, and finally, at the end, the Moors fought so hard to preserve Granada that Isabel and her family and her troops actually established a camp outside of the city of Granada and showed that they were going to stay as long as it took to get to have the Moors leave, and they did, and they left by surrender. Initially, she had told, there were many hundreds of thousands of Muslims living in Andalusia in the south of Spain, and initially she told them that they could maintain their faith, but the two religions did not live harmoniously from then on, and gradually Isabella and her descendants forced them all to convert to Christianity or leave, which is the same thing that she did to the Jews.
Yeah, and this is the other side of Isabella. She was sort of this bundle of contradictions. When Columbus brings back slaves, she's infuriated.
Yes.
And she was infuriated by the enslavement of Christians in the Moorish Empire. In fact, some of her first buildings, she forced the manacles to be put up on the wall so people would see what had occurred. And yet, she was capable of inflicting the same sort of damage to people who do not believe in the Christian faith, and she instigated the Inquisition.
The Inquisition is really a horrifying part of Spanish history, and I think it has its roots in the war that occurred, but there is no question. Isabel was religiously intolerant herself. She was very religious, Christian, Catholic. She felt it was her duty to, as guardian of the souls of her subjects, to ensure that everyone was a Christian Catholic, but she did it ruthlessly. And there was no concept in Isabel's world, gradually, as this came, as she got more and more power, of religious tolerance. And in fact, that's one of the things that has had huge echoes for us in the United States, is the religious intolerance that Isabella showed still horrified Western civilization so much that our founding fathers specifically had the Inquisition in mind when they established the freedom of religion as a constitutional amendment.
Yeah. Well, do you believe that one of the reasons for the Inquisition was because she was still in the process of unifying Spain?
Yes.
It was a byproduct of that?
Yes. She was terrified. I think one of the things that was a big turning point in my research, I was trying to understand what are all the pieces of this woman? How do you get all these different facts and you get all these different psychological pictures of who she was, and what is the defining psychological characteristic of her? And I was at the Biblioteca Nacional in Madrid, the main national library there, and I got access to an old magazine about royal places, and I was looking at places that were associated with royalty, and I saw a discussion of a place in Burgos, a monastery in Burgos, where they had a portrait of Isabella that she had commissioned, and that picture gave me huge insight. That portrait, it shows Isabella and her family cowering under the arms of a militant Virgin Mary, and above, in the sky above, demons are dancing. And I realized she was very, very afraid for her mortal soul and afraid for her life and that of her family. She saw her Christianity as the thing that would protect her against some terror that was coming. And unfortunately, there were terrifying events that were happening not far from Spain as the Ottoman Turks advanced on Europe.
Yeah, that was the thing I found was really interesting, was that there was a mortal fear across Europe that with the Ottoman Empire expanding, you know, we think of the Muslim Empire as sort of growing during, say, 700 through about 1,000, but there was another period of expansion in the Ottomans into Eastern Europe. The loss of Constantinople happened during Isabella's lifetime, and there were forays into the Balkans at that particular point.
Right.
All of the monarchies of Europe really feared this.
Well, they did, and they feared it more the closer they were. When Isabella was 2 years old, the Ottoman Turks besieged and conquered Constantinople, which, remember, had been the old seat of Christianity from when the Roman Empire had split up. Constantinople was the Rome of its time for many centuries. So when the Turks conquered Constantinople, they took over the city. They destroyed a lot of the holy relics, and they carted off the Christians who lived there into slavery. That happened when she was 2 years old. Then the Turks began and conquered Greece, Albania, Bosnia, went into Hungary, and were heading for Vienna, and that happened all during her lifetime. They also successfully invaded the boot of Italy at a town called Otranto, and actually managed to seize the southern part of Italy. They ended up leaving there fairly quickly, but during Isabella's life, very terrible, large military was on its way. They were saying they planned to take all of Europe, and their tactics were very similar to those that we see today with ISIS.
Yeah, and the other thing is that you have to realize we're about 100 years or so away from the Reformation. Henry VIII married Isabella's daughter.
Yes.
And so you have that these forces that are a part of the Catholic Church, as this was the Church at this particular point was at perhaps its lowest ebb as far as faithfulness, and you had this force that was incredibly faithful, and religion was very much a part of the expansion versus a sort of a faltering Christianity at that particular point
due to
the corruption.
The Vatican was run during her lifetime and during her reign by the Borgia family. The infamous Rodrigo Borgia became Pope Alexander VI. He was, in fact, a Spaniard from Aragon. And so that meant that not just did she have contact with him, she knew how corrupt he was, and she was dismayed by his behavior. She thought he was undermining Christianity with his own with his vices.
Yeah, and in fact, they were not in the same camp at all. And in fact, they were sort of loggerheads through most of that. What's also interesting about Isabella is literally within months of subduing Granada, she's sending Columbus to the New World.
Yes.
And this was really not so much Ferdinand. Ferdinand was concerned with the Mediterranean. Isabella saw the possibilities. Was she seduced by Columbus's stories, or was it a more pragmatic view of, I see that the Portuguese are exploring the world, we had better too?
Well, she was actually half Portuguese. Her mother mm-hmm. was Portuguese. Her grandmother, who lived with her during her childhood, was Portuguese. And they were all related to Prince Henry the Navigator.
Right.
So she came from a family that very much, very early on, saw the potential of overseas expansion. She was terrified by the Ottoman Turks and their aggression in Europe, and they controlled the Silk Route that gave access to the spices and silks of the Orient. And she realized that for them to get access to that, they were going to have to find a different way around the globe. So she sent Columbus as soon as she could, as soon as her wartime obligations ended. She sent him just as she conquered and finished the conquest of Granada. And he wasn't the only one she sent. She sent six other explorers, too. In between 1492 and 1504, when Isabel died, she sent nine separate trips of expedition to the New World. And they ended up mapping the area from Central America down to Brazil, part of the reason that Isabella was able to claim all the much of that land for her own kingdom. She claimed it for Castile, and that is why we have all these cities in the United States that have Spanish names.
And really, it's quite remarkable. I mean, she really managed to, within her reign, change Spain and its various kingdoms from sort of a backwater to what would become, over the next 200 years, one of the primary powers of Europe.
Well, really the primary power of Europe. And one of the reasons that our view of Spain is so negative is because it comes from the English, who were very jealous of Spain's wealth and power. The best they could do was send out pirates to try to steal stuff the Spanish were collecting.
They did beat off the Armada, though.
They very successfully beat off the Armada. And of course, you know, they ended up recognizing the value of the places in North America that the Spanish hadn't wanted to go and live.
Right.
And thus we have our culture.
That's right. Kirsten Downey, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me.
Biographer Kirsten Downey is the author of Isabella, the Warrior Queen. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.